It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, civil discourse has turned pretty uncivil in a lot of American politics. We'll get a preview of a UW-Madison conference looking for ways to change that here in Wisconsin. First, the way we use social media platforms and the platforms themselves are changing. Facebook has had slower than planned growth, and its parent company Meta has seen a more than 60% decrease in value. And Twitter faces an uncertain future after its purchase by Elon Musk. Apps like TikTok and those promoting authenticity like Be Real are gaining popularity, especially among teens. We're taking the pulse of the social media world, and we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you go to one or more platforms on a regular basis? Do you like that you go to those platforms, or you just feel kind of hooked on them at this point? Has the way you use social media changed over the years or in recent months? What do you see family members, kids, your seniors using? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, if that's one of the platforms you use. Steve Knoll is marketing instructor at Madison College and a close observer of the social media landscape. Steve, welcome back.
Great. Thanks for having me again, Rob.
There are a zillion moving parts. Steve, what do you have your eye on these days?
Well, other than Twitter, let's not talk about that right now.
Sure.
It has been interesting to see what's going on with Facebook and specifically Meta, as they call themselves. You know, over the pandemic, usage of both Facebook and Instagram went up, including a lot of revenue, because advertisers realized it was a great medium to reach people while they're at home. But now that people have been journeying back out into the world, journeying back out into physical stores, revenue is down for the company. And that's kind of a concerning for them, is coming out of the pandemic, how this is affecting their business model. You know, it's the pandemic really upended everything, but a lot of companies, I think, are going to have to go through an adjustment period as we kind of get back to, you know, what used to be called normal.
When we talk about social media, I mean, Facebook, I'm looking at the chart of the biggest platforms. Facebook is number one, close to 3 billion users worldwide, yep, according to Facebook. You know, it's the biggest game in town. They were looking at maybe incredible growth to go on and on and on forever. They're not getting smaller when it comes to the number of users, but that growth has slowed down pretty significantly, right?
Oh, absolutely. And this is definitely related to post-pandemic consumer habits. You know, online shopping is down. People are enjoying, you know, real-world shopping again. They're not going to stop online shopping. But the idea of scrolling through Facebook and seeing that weird little product that you can order, you know, a lot of that stuff that was so popular over the pandemic has just evaporated. And really now just more traditional advertisers have been kind of left with Facebook, which is still a lot. It's still a giant audience. And you have to remember, the demographic of Facebook tends to be older. We're talking, you know, people 40 plus, 50 plus. And that demographic does have a lot of spending money. So even though, you know, their numbers are down, they're still going to be, they're going to be fine. You know, I think this is really just more of an adjustment from the post-pandemic era than any type of, you know, long-term trend that they may be experiencing.
And the parent company of Facebook now, it's called Meta. And yep, part of the deal there is they're creating the virtual reality social media platform of the future. How's that going so far?
It depends on who you ask. So, you know, the big barrier is the hardware. You know, they do have, well, what was originally called the Oculus headset. And if you're into virtual reality, it's a really fun tool, mostly for gaming. But it is a very interesting way to interact with, you know, people from literally all over the world in a kind of pseudo physical environment. They have since renamed it the Meta headset. That's caused some confusion, since Oculus was a pretty good brand name for people who are into all that stuff. But I really think they're playing the long game with this. You know, they're not really looking at a metaverse emerging in the next few years. They're really looking at in the next few decades, as the technology becomes easier to use, lighter, more like putting on a pair of reading glasses than putting on a clunky headset. So I think maybe in 10 years, yeah, I think instead of surfing somebody's Instagram feed, you will more like immerse yourself into someone's Instagram feed. But I still think we're quite a ways away from that actually happening.
Talking to Steve Knoll from Madison College, looking at the ever-changing landscape of social media. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear your experience, your bit of data, if you will. What do you use? What have you stopped using? Have you avoided the whole thing altogether? Has it turned you away for some reason? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Steve, let's jump down the list a little bit to TikTok. Mm-hmm. About a billion users worldwide. That's not nothing. Yep. That's quite a bit. A lot, it seems like a lot of interest among younger people in particular, and people tend to use it for bigger chunks of time, and advertisers, if I understand correctly, kind of like that.
They do. The one thing about TikTok, it's kind of closer to something like YouTube than it is to something like Facebook or Instagram, where it's almost its own entertainment channel as much as it's a social medium. So that's really attractive to advertisers, because the more time that people spend using on something, the more comfortable they are taking that little brief commercial break. So advertisers definitely kind of like how that connects. The one drawback to TikTok is that it does skew very young. It's very much a, you know, teenagers, 20-something dominated group. You know, once you really get past the 25, 30-year-old demographic, you know, those numbers are on there, but those users drop significantly in numbers. So it does come back to the advertising thing and what companies really are going after that 20-year-old demographic. You know, that's the one negative on TikTok. It's very popular. It's a lot of time is spent on it, but the number of businesses out there that really could benefit from using it as an advertising tool is fairly narrow. But you have to remember, TikTok has another business model. You know, ultimately, it is, you know, connected to, you know, the Chinese government. They're collecting your user information specifically to show you ads for Chinese-made products. You know, TikTok was really built as a way to connect people to Chinese-made products. And that's been a very controversial thing about TikTok. And while they've taken, especially the American version of TikTok has taken, you know, a lot of steps to kind of separate that, that still is a big revenue model for TikTok. They're getting money from China just to run the app. So TikTok doesn't really need to be as heavily relied on advertising as the other social medias do.
And that's a wild card. I mean, we see the FBI director testifying before Congress that they have national security concerns about the company's ties with the Chinese government. Wisconsin Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher joined up with Senator Marco Rubio saying we need legislation to out and out ban TikTok. I don't know if a ban will happen, but some kind of a new regulation, it seems very likely.
Well, yeah, I think a ban is just not realistic. But yeah, that's the thing is, this app is what's referred to as a data scraper. You know, once you download it onto your phone, when you give it permission to use, nobody ever reads the terms of the user agreement. You know, the app does have access to other things on your phone, you know, photos, other apps, other data. And there's a question as to how much it really gets. Does it get into your bank account? Does it read your emails? You know, all this other stuff. There are a lot of like questions about that have not been answered. So, you know, as much as, you know, I think TikTok in the grand scheme of things is relatively harmless, because really, if they're collecting data on you, it's to pair you up with Chinese made products. It's not necessarily to hack your identity or anything like that. So it's a little malicious, but certainly there are other apps out there that are extremely dangerous. But TikTok is more cautious than dangerous.
We're talking to Steve Knoll, marketing instructor at Madison College, about changes in social media usage and the apps themselves. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you check Facebook daily? Do you post a lot? Do you used to use it a lot more and now you've faded or even gotten out of it altogether? If you are on Twitter, are you getting off Twitter given big changes there? Do you watch things on TikTok or YouTube, a very big social media platform we haven't talked about? Let us know how you relate to social media. Do you think it's bad for you, or do you worry about how it affects kids? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Steve Knoll, marketing instructor at Madison College, with us today to talk about how some people are starting to use social media differently, the rise and fall, or at least the decline of various platforms, and you can join in with your own story. 800-642-1234. Do you use social media differently than you used to? More? Less? What's changed for you? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Miles joins us now in Green Bay. Miles, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Miles?
I just wanted to mention a change that I've kind of seen across social media, especially in places like YouTube, where I think it had become a really good place, and it still is a really good place to get good information and find like tutorials and stuff and, you know, how to do everything from fix your furnace to something else. But I feel like as we've seen more and more people go to it and try to find ways to like monetize their content, I feel like it's just getting harder and harder to find meaningful information. Like, I don't think you can find a video that's shorter than 10 minutes these days. And I'm guessing that all has to do with how it's monetized and how many ads they can serve you. And people that are making good content are burying 30 seconds of good information in a 10-minute video. And sometimes I just give up lately and go back to trying to find written sources and stuff like that.
Interesting, Miles. Thanks a lot for the call. Steve Miles using YouTube, like a lot of people, for fix-it advice and things like that. What are you watching for with changes at YouTube? There have been that you can see right on their front page lately.
Well, Miles absolutely nailed it with that one. Is TikTok, YouTube recently changed how people who are posting videos and monetizing it get paid. There's now a minimum amount of minutes per month as well as a minimum amount of videos they have to upload. And as a result, you're right, like a 1-minute tutorial has to be stretched out to a certain length just so they can monetize it. This is why I mentioned TikTok first. A lot of people have gravitated to TikTok for tutorial information because there's a lot of 30-second, 1-minute how to do things all over TikTok. That's actually a very, very popular use of that app. And it seems like that it's really supplanting YouTube as a place to go for quick little pieces of information. I myself... you know, have really stopped going to YouTube when I'm trying to, you know, learn a piece of software or something. And instead I'll look it up on TikTok and I find, you know, just as good information, but 30 seconds. I don't have to sit through the other 9.5 minutes of fluff to get what I need.
Thanks a lot for that call, Miles, at 800-642-1234. Christopher joins us now in Delavan. Christopher, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I just wanted to make the comment about, you know, you hear a lot about these studies that show that people who, you know, spend time on social media apps, there's a, like, seems to be a relation with, like, depression and, you know, negative attitudes and feelings and stuff like that. And also, I just wanted to, you know, add on to what Miles was talking about with how, and it ties in my comments as well, that the monetization of these social media platforms, they don't, you know, their goal isn't to put like correct information forward or the concern about their users. It's just about, you know, how can we get the most ads shown? How can we generate the most money? And, you know, stuff like that is a good example.
Christopher, thanks a lot for the call. Steve, we have seen concern about, you know, people who end up engaging or spending a lot of time on social media may not feel great about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely been studies about the psychological addiction of social media. It's definitely a real thing. But there's also people who spend, you know, hours and hours in front of the television. That's been going on for decades. And there really isn't any different than somebody, you know, spending, you know, just hours just watching TV shows left and right than there is on social media. They're all forms of you know, psychological addictions that are related to depression issues. So I think that, yeah, it's definitely a concern, but it's really, it's not anything we haven't seen before. I think all mediums will have some type of addictive quality to them. And, you know, that does kind of cross over into the other part about advertising as well. Ironically, it's the users of the social media who are demanding these ads, because nobody is willing to pay for a social media app. They have done many studies saying, would you pay $10 a month to get, you know, a social media app with no ads? And virtually no one will agree to do that. YouTube offers an ad-free subscription plan. I think it's about $15 a month, and very few people take advantage of that. So, you know, in one hand, you know, people say all these social media companies don't care. All they do is they exist to show ads. But on the other hand, it's really the fault of the consumer, because these social media companies are businesses. They have to make money somehow. And if consumers aren't willing to subscribe, the other business model is an advertising supported model. And overwhelmingly, consumers have said they prefer a social or an advertising social media business model infinitely more popular than a paid subscription model. And that's just how it's going to be until people start signing up into the few subscriptions that are out there. Until they really start gaining traction, that's not going to change.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about the changing landscape of social media with Steve Knoll from Madison College. All right, Steve, you made me put it off till later. Let's talk about Twitter. Now, not one of the biggest networks out there compared to a Facebook, much smaller user base, but kind of outsized influence in some ways because of a lot of politics and media congregates there, I think, just bought by Elon Musk with some other investors. We could spend 2 hours talking about it. What are you watching for at Twitter in particular, though?
I was going to say, Elon Musk bought Twitter. I hadn't heard about that. So yeah, you're right. Twitter is much smaller in terms of the user base. But what makes Twitter really unique is it's one of the few social media that really is a real-time medium. You know, something being posted on Twitter 20 minutes ago is considered yesterday's news for practical purposes. And that's really what makes Twitter unique, is the speed of how information travels, good or bad. Because obviously we've seen that, you know, incorrect, false information can also travel at the speed of light on Twitter. So, but, you know, I think that the medium itself is very interesting. Now, what Elon Musk is doing, is that's been the real head scratcher, because all signs seem to point that he bought this on a whim and doesn't really have a business plan. And now maybe he does, and this is some brilliant behind the scenes marketing plan to keep attention on it. Wow. If that's true, he really is the most brilliant person ever. But so far, it really seems to be a bit of a dumpster fire. You know, it's they're changing things every day, sometimes every hour. They're announcing things and then rolling it back. You know, it's in one way, I find it really fascinating to watch, but it is kind of like watching, you know, a train wreck in slow motion. You know, the big question is how long can it financially survive? If I was running paid advertising campaigns on Twitter, I absolutely would suspend them. It's too volatile. It's too unpredictable. And you can just see it, you know, as somebody who's been using Twitter for 10 years myself, Twitter, what it looks like this week is radically different than what it looked like last week, just in terms of what's being posted and what's not being posted. And it's interesting to watch, but at the same point too, it's definitely losing its relevance as a really good, you know, information tool. And that's just for me, but I think that's for a lot of people. So if advertisers are saying, we're a little scared about this, how long is it going to be before it kind of implodes? You know, or is there some secret idea behind the scenes that nobody knows about? That's literally the $44 billion question.
And Steve, just our last minute and a half or so, a lot of layoffs from Twitter and Meta slash Facebook.
Yep.
A lot of talented people out there now probably looking for work. Do you see maybe an opportunity for someone to come out of nowhere with a big new social media platform that we don't even know the name of today?
Possibly. You know, it all comes down to, you know, they can launch something new, like Be Real, that came out in the last year or so. The big question is, a lot of social media apps come out, they get popular for 6 months, and then once the newness wears off, they wither on the vine and die. So these social media apps, really, they're businesses. You have to have a business model to support it. And that's the thing, is people raise venture capital, they launch an app, and then they discover they don't have a way to sustain it, and the whole thing collapses. So will there be more apps? Yes, there will be. Is there going to be one that's going to become the next Twitter? I don't know about that. I really don't see, you know, a different business model other than subscription or ad supported that would even allow a new app like that to even exist. So unfortunately, I think we're stuck with what we have.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Great. Thanks again, Rob.
That's Steve Knoll, marketing instructor at Madison College. He joined us to talk about changes in how people are using social media and what apps are gaining popularity. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, two UW-Madison journalism professors joined the show to talk about the state of civil discourse, in some cases the lack of same, and how to revitalize it here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a doctor says there's a me versus us divide when it comes to health in the United States, and that more emphasis on public health can be good for all of us. Now, if you've tuned into American politics lately, you probably know our civil discourse can feel kind of uncivil. Our next guests say we need to change that, and we can. They're holding conversations with academics, journalists, political leaders, and members of the public to figure out ways to bring back civil discourse across party lines. That's all part of a UW-Madison conference called Renewing Civic Life in Wisconsin, Fulfilling the Legacy of Bill Krause. It starts at 9 tomorrow morning at Gordon Commons on UW-Madison's campus. It's open to the public, and you could stream it live on Zoom. You can find info at wpr.org/centraltime. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the way we talk about politics change? What would it take to change it for the better? Have you had experiences in your own life talking to people with different political beliefs? Have you stopped talking to friends, family, coworkers because of political differences? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Mike Wagner is a professor in UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He's affiliated with the Department of Political Science and the La Follette School of Public Affairs. He's a faculty affiliate at the Elections Research Center. Mike, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here, Rob.
And Louis Friedland is a professor in UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He's with the Department of Sociology, and he founded and directs the Center for Communication and Democracy. Lou, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Rob. Good to see you.
I want to start by talking about Bill Krause, the inspiration for this conference. I've interviewed him. I used to book him on talk shows all the time. When I saw his name, I think I get what this conference is about. Mike, can you talk a little bit about him?
Sure. Bill Krause was a person who helped make careers of Republican politicians in Wisconsin in the 1970s and 80s. He was, you know, a person kind of responsible for running the Dreyfus campaign for Governor Dreyfus. He also was really important in negotiating and making the UW system happen, in getting the landmark 1982, I think, gay rights bill passed in Wisconsin. And the reason he was able to do those things was kind of the reason we want to have this conference. He was very well known for talking across party lines. He was a partisan Republican who worked with Democrats, who trusted that you could have conversations with people who you disagreed with to find common ground to achieve something. And after he stopped his work in kind of, you know, political life when it came to working in government, then he ran Common Cause in Wisconsin for a few decades, the watchdog group which monitors government spending and how government uses its power. And so he's a person who is universally respected amongst Republicans and Democrats in our state, and his orientation towards civility, compromise, trust, building trust across lines of difference are the sort of things we want to highlight and have a conversation about with our guests and folks who want to come to Gordon Commons tomorrow at 9. We'll be there 9 to 5, open to the public.
And Lou, do you want to jump on that point there, learning from Bill Krause, taking those lessons, this conference tomorrow, and trying to recreate that concept of, hey, we could talk to each other?
Right. I think that's – Bill Krause really did represent the ability to talk to each other. It's really in some ways that simple. He was also an incredibly nice guy. I used to appear on him on the old weekend show on Wisconsin Public Television some years ago. And Bill, first of all, he knew almost everything about Wisconsin politics. There literally wasn't a topic that he couldn't talk about knowledgeably off the top of his head. And he was just such a nice person.
Now, Mike, you and actually you've been part of a team doing research on how we talk about politics, the media we watch, things like that. And the concept of, hey, this guy's a Republican, but he worked with Democrats. He talked to Democrats. He got along with Democrats. Seems like a quaint throwback to a different era. What kind of things are you looking for these days in your research about how we've moved away from that?
Well, we see at the legislative level in our state that there's not a lot of conversation across party lines, at least that takes place publicly, that's very positive. There's a lot of gridlock. There's a lot of the governor, say, calling a special session and the legislature, you know, the other party gaveling in and gaveling out. And so we see lots of those kinds of things, or the legislature passing a high number of bills and the governor vetoing them. And so there's not a lot of conversation across party lines that seems very productive amongst our elites. But we also see that conversation and then the conversations that happen on social media, talk radio, and the news around that is bleeding into our own regular daily lives in Wisconsin. And so things we've discovered in our own research show that more than 6 in 10 Wisconsinites say that they've stopped talking about politics to somebody because they disagree. Most of those they put in the family and friend category. So it's not that they go to work and agree just to talk about the Badgers or the Packers. It's family and friends that they're stopping talking politics with. And 1 in 5 say that they've just outright ended a familial relationship or friendship because of these disagreements. And that's just not common in our relatively recent history in our state. We've been able to talk across party lines. People like Bill Krause did that very productively, and we're seeing less and less of that as partisan animus, contentious politics, misinformation, all these sorts of things bubble up and make it much more difficult to have productive conversations across party lines.
And Lou, I could see this being a downward spiral. If we're talking to each other less, we're going to know each other less, we're going to like each other less, we're going to talk less. What are the prospects for turning that around?
I'm not sure. That's a good question, Rob. And I think the question is, are there places where we can have civil conversations? Where are the spaces where people will talk to each other across different lines of disagreement? You know, WPR is one of those places where people do manage to have that public conversation. But what we need to have, and encouraging them is difficult, there's more conversations in the networks and the social spaces that people actually live in. Just like people are separating in those spaces, we need to figure out ways that they can begin to talk to each other again. They may not agree. In fact, chances are very good that they won't agree on many things, but to at least be able to listen to someone.
And there's nothing, Mike, in principle wrong with people disagreeing. I mean, our country was designed to have disagreeing parties come together and agree, you know, or compromise at least somewhere along the way. How do we get back to civil disagreement, though?
I think one thing has to do with people being willing to accept the idea that when somebody disagrees with them, it doesn't automatically mean that that person's values and value are suspect. People might highlight different values in their own individual lives, and they might apply those to the things they would like to see happen politically. And it's not necessarily that people are nefarious or have ill intent with views they have that are different than our own. And so when I talk to people about engaging in conversation across party lines or talking with the family around, say, the Thanksgiving dinner table about misinformation when people are sharing things that aren't true, I would say aim for the heart and not the head, right? If facts worked, we wouldn't need to do more than present facts to people. But part of this is that we have to trust each other well enough and be willing to listen to each other to say, you have a different view than me. Why don't you tell me about that, rather than me saying to myself, well, when he's done talking, I will let him know why I am right, which is just a less productive way to engage in conversation about really tough matters that we ask our elected officials to help resolve for us.
Talking to Mike Wagner and Lou Friedland from UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. They are organizers of a big conference tomorrow aimed at helping restore civic conversations about politics, civil conversations about politics here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. John is with us in Brookfield. John, hi.
Hey, how you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, John?
Yeah, I work for a trucking company, and I am one of four of about 130 truck drivers that are a Democrat. When we come in the morning, we wait for our loads in a driver's room, and all you hear is complaining back and forth between the Republican people and the Democratic people. And it's just, I'm almost to the point where I want to quit the job. I've been there 10 years. I love the job, but it's like everything's so volatile now because of what if you're a Democrat or Republican, it's horrible.
Do you are there things you could talk to your colleagues about, John? Is sports a safe topic, or just down?
No, we have a TV in there, and there's sports on all the time, and for some reason it turns into politics.
Huh. Interesting. John, thanks a lot for sharing that story. John's not alone. A lot of people, I think, Lou, find themselves in workplaces, in families, whatever, where they're the odd. I've talked to listeners who say, I'm in my community, I'm the odd one out.
Yeah, in workplaces in particular, Rob, there's good research that shows that actually that's where there are lines of difference, because people generally aren't screened for their politics before they get a job, whatever it might be. And yet, so you have more heterogeneous or different kinds of people in the same room in a workplace. And that means, of course, that there's more likely to be some disagreement. And then how that gets processed is a tricky subject, right? Because if you're working alongside someone, you want to get along with them. You probably don't want to be engaged in conflict. But if they've pressed your political hot button, it's very hard. You know, people stop sitting there having that fluid conversation and start to wait, as Mike said, to jump in on the conversation. And then a vicious spiral gets set off.
Thanks a lot for sharing your experience. We'll go now to Denny in Ogdensburg. Denny, hi.
Hi, I've taken a different tack. When I'm a political animal, I study these things, and I ask people just to tell me when they want to talk, what are the four or five most important things to them? And I just listen till they're done talking, and they generally say, what's important to you? And I respond generally by acknowledging that whatever they had on their list is important to me, but it may not be the most important thing. And what stuns me is what Winston Churchill said: you want to find the biggest problem with democracy, spend 5 minutes talking to the average voter. It stuns me how few people know the difference between the deficit and the debt, or the CO2 level, or the cost of health care. They just get tied up in the minutiae, but by me letting them talk about what's important to them, then acknowledging that and taking it from there, it's worked for me.
Denny, thanks a lot for sharing that. Mike, I've talked to people who talk about how to talk through conflict, and they say, don't start with the controversy, start with values, and you're probably going to find some shared values like Denny says he did.
I think that's right, and our own work bears that out a bit as we look at people who have conversations across lines of difference and can do so in ways that aren't bringing up the tension are also people who tend to be more moderate in their politics. They tend to split their tickets more when they vote. And so people who are, you know, exposed in these situations, both like your first caller was talking about and then like Denny was talking about, there are elements of it that are uncomfortable, right? But there are also benefits because you get to learn about what the other side thinks. And sometimes that can actually have a moderating influence on our own views to say, oh, you know, these people aren't, you know, they don't have the negative traits that my preferred news sources tell me the other side has. These are people I can see living and breathing right in front of me. And when we have those kinds of interactions, they can help to moderate us. They don't always, right? Sometimes people are going to push our buttons and as Denny says, if it's something I really care about, I'm probably not open to changing my opinion about it as compared to an issue where I don't think about it as much. And so it's very complicated, which is why it's such a hard set of problems to solve.
Thanks for that call, Denny. We're talking to Mike Wagner and Lou Friedland from UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, here to talk about a conference they're hosting tomorrow called Renewing Civic Life in Wisconsin. Find info about how to participate in person or online at WPR.org/Central Time, and you can call in at 800-642-1234. What do you think we can do to change the way we talk with each other about politics, especially when we disagree? Has it been an impossible dream for you and your family or your workplace to have a civil conversation about political issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Mike Wagner and Lou Friedland from UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. With us today to talk about a conference they're hosting tomorrow about restoring civic life and civil conversation here in Wisconsin. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234 with Elise in Ashland. Elise, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up, Elise?
Excellent. Well, you know, what you were talking about, you know, the system being designed to handle disagreements and such like, and to some extent it was, and to some extent it wasn't, right? You know, the system was definitely designed to accommodate differences of opinion on, you know, whether or not to go to war with France, but on whether or not to, you know, curtail slavery, whether or not to limit the power of the wealthy. Those are things that our Constitution was not really designed to allow. And when people did start having disagreements, it did end in bloodshed. And I'm very much of the belief that it couldn't have gone any other way. And now, you know, to use a more modern example, you know, so the idea is that, you know, with this golden age where people would sit down and talk and come to compromises, had a lot of assumptions about who was making the compromises on behalf of whom. In my personal case, you know, I'm a trans woman. And, you know, and of course there's all this talk about when someone gets to know a member of a community that's being questioned, right, then of course they'll be more receptive. Well, you know, my biological father, who I'd, you know, known since birth, when I came out, he forbade the entire family to have anything to do with me, to have any contact with me. My grandmother's sick right now, and I'm actually asking to be allowed to visit her in the hospital. But, you know, and, you know, he'd voted Democrat every time in his life, but I believe he's voted Republican ever since then. I don't know. He hasn't spoken to me for 6 years.
I'm sorry to hear that, Elise. Best on dealing with that family situation. But Elise makes an interesting point. Lou, we sometimes think of a golden age where people got together and, you know, compromised. But it might have been a small elite subset, and a lot of people weren't at the table in the first place.
Well, certainly there was a period, there have been recurring periods in American life where large groups of people were excluded from the table, and worse, were persecuted, as Elise's story invokes. And that's part of our history. There's no question about that, and some of that is conflict. And, of course, the Civil War. And then the Jim Crow that followed was the largest simmering, ongoing, still ongoing conflict in American life. So no, it wasn't a simple case of we used to have a golden age and now it's declined. That said, there have been also cyclical periods when people could work out differences. Civil society ebbs and flows. In the pre-Civil War period, it was obviously coming apart, and the Civil War was the result of that coming apart. In the post-war period, despite continuing racism and sexism, there was also a way that people could resolve disagreements institutionally. Unions, for example, made a huge difference in bringing people together across race and gender lines to some extent, and allowing people to say we have some common views and common interests. So institutions do matter. Institutions have fault lines, and when those fault lines start to split apart, then conflict in everyday civil life also becomes more exacerbated.
Elise, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234, talking about civil society and civil political communication in Wisconsin with Lou Friedland and Mike Wagner from UW-Madison's School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, we hear a lot about the places where we're divided. You know, we maybe watch different media outlets. We do different things. In your research, have you found remaining, at least vestiges of places where people from different backgrounds, different opinions can interact in a positive or at least neutral way?
There are a few political issues even where there's broad agreement across party lines, and one of which is a really hot button one in Wisconsin that WPR News did a great podcast about, looking at redistricting. And in Wisconsin, in our survey, majorities of Democrats, Republicans, and independents support a nonpartisan redistricting commission. And this is especially remarkable because the Republicans in our sample who say we would prefer a nonpartisan commission recognize that they're the beneficiaries of the current system in terms of how redistricting works in Wisconsin. So there are places, there are issues where citizens across party lines recognize issues of basic fairness and how those things might manifest themselves from a policy point of view.
Lou, I wanted to ask you about the media in all of this. That covers a lot of ground. There's some media outlets who exist to exacerbate, I think, these differences. For those who aren't doing that, though, are there things you think that we could be doing to help provide forums for civil communication?
Well, I think one of the biggest changes in Wisconsin's always had historically a very healthy newspaper industry. Every town of any size, 5,000-10,000, had a daily newspaper that covered the ongoing affairs of that community. As we all know who've been following this, and I think most listeners do too, those newspapers have shrunk. They've been consolidated into ever larger sets of corporations. And their budgets have shrunk, and so they cover the community less and less. That was a space of common conversation. The media, particularly newspapers, and then television and radio tend to follow the newspapers for news. That was a space where a kind of implicitly civil conversation took place. As that's declined, there's less and less common space. And one of the things that's filled that void in Wisconsin is particularly, frankly, conservative talk radio.
Mike, the conference tomorrow, I know you've been living and breathing it for a while now. What are you hoping comes out of this event?
Well, we're hoping that we can have conversations about strategies to have productive conversation across lines of difference. We also want to tell the truth about what we know empirically about the state of democracy, the state of civil society in Wisconsin. We want to hear perspectives from journalists, so we'll have a more academic panel at about 10:15. We'll hear from journalists at 1:15. We'll have a keynote from Tommy Thompson, former governor, at 4 o'clock. All of this in Gordon Commons on campus, all open to the public. What we're hoping to get out of it is beginnings of conversations. Let's start conversations about things we might be able to agree on. Let's start conversations at least that establish that we want to keep having conversations about hard issues, which is something that we ought to be able to do in a state like ours where people are deeply informed as compared to folks in other states. They are more participatory as compared to folks in other states. And so we ought to be able to find ways to continue having hard conversations across party lines where we've been lagging behind other states in recent years.
We'll leave it there. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
And Lou, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rob.
Been talking to Lou Friedland and Mike Wagner. They're both professors in UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, with us today to talk about this conference they are hosting tomorrow. It's called Renewing Civic Life in Wisconsin, Fulfilling the Legacy of Bill Krause. The conference, as you heard, goes from 9 to 5 tomorrow at Gordon Commons on UW-Madison's campus. It's open to the public, and you could stream it live on Zoom. We've got conference information, details on how to connect via Zoom at wpr.org/centraltime. Find a link there. Check it out. let us know if you appreciate what came out of it. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, cryptocurrencies have dropped in value a lot over the course of this year, and one of the stars of the industry is in the midst of a total collapse. Find out what's happening in the strange and often inscrutable world of blockchains and electronic coins. Join in with your questions and maybe your experiences if you listened to the Super Bowl ads and tried investing in alternative currencies yourself. That conversation's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. We are a week out from Thanksgiving, and there's a good chance you're coming up with plans for food, whether you're hosting or bringing a dish to pass. Turkey always gets a lot of the attention, the dessert too, but what about the unsung heroes, the side dishes? A new non-scientific analysis from the food wholesaler Food Service Direct rates the top side dishes around the country and by state. They use data from their own sales and internet searches for recipes. Here's the top five nationwide. I'm counting down here. 5, sweet potato casserole. Number 4, cranberry sauce. 3, green bean casserole. 2, mashed potatoes. Number 1, macaroni and cheese. I don't think a mac and cheese is a Thanksgiving side, but there it is. Here in Wisconsin, the number 1 side, according to the report, is the classic green bean casserole. You know, the one with the crispy fried onions in a jar that only exists, I think, to put on this casserole. One question I have, where's the stuffing? Food news you can use. This is Central Time.